Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Emil DeFelice of South Carolina's Kaka Farms was recently featured in the New York Times as a farmer of the New South. We'll talk with Emil about new-style Southern farming. Then, Trey Lytle is returning the centuries-old practice of rum distilling to Louisiana's sugarcane fields. He's here to tell us all about Louisiana spirits in Lacassine. Stay tuned for that and more on this week's Louisiana Eats. The New York Times recently identified Emil DeFelice as a Southern farmer who was vanquishing the cliches. Emil raises heritage breed pigs at Kaka Creek Farms in Columbia, South Carolina, in what he describes as a managed wild setting. New York Times writer Julia Moskin also noted that it's easy to get Emil riled up. Emil, I hear you don't look like a Southern pig farmer.
What? I'm going to hit the roof of my Prius if you keep it up, Poppy.
So what's a Southern pig farmer supposed to look like?
That is the question, you know, and that sort of like gets right to the point of the article. Like, what is Southern food supposed to look like? Am I supposed to go around overalls, rubber boots, stinking to high heaven all day? I don't think so. You know, I bathe, I use cutlery, I have indoor plumbing. The works. There you go. That's, you know, a part of, you know, a good way to look at that question that they were talking about, which is, what is this Southern food? You know, we're on a phenomenon of Southern culture and Southern food and slow food and sustainable farming and all that. And it's great for some time just to grow and have cheerleading. And at some point down the line, you have to get critical and ask different questions, maybe harder questions.
Well, I'd like you to tell our audience a little bit about your farming practices at Kaka Creek, some of the things that set you apart from a traditional pig farmer.
Well, Kaka Creek really is a traditional pig farmer. And so it's, what do we call conventional now and what do we call traditional? So if you just rewind, say, 75 years or something like that, everybody did what Kaka Creek is doing now, and certainly what other folks around the country are attempting to do, which is to raise old breeds of hogs outdoors to proper weights without the use of trickery, synthetic drugs. Otherwise, all my pigs vote Republican and go to church and don't gamble or drink. So it's just an old-fashioned way of raising pigs, and what that means on the ground, if you were to see it. Imagine a big wagon wheel, and the different sections between the spokes are the areas where the animals would be rotated through periodically, in which they get after that area pretty good, then open the gate, move them to the next spot.
Emil, I know that your farm is certified humane. Would you explain the benefits of that and how that affects your business?
Yeah, that's the most stringent and respected animal welfare certification in the United States. And it exceeds the other types of certifications, be they third party or, in most cases, self-certification. Put it this way. A sick pig, an unhappy pig, an unhealthy pig, costs money and doesn't do anyone any good. So when you have a system that promotes the animal's health and well-being, you get a more uniformly healthy animal, and in essence, they are allowed to take care of themselves, you know, in a way that's better in some ways than we could take care of them if we had our hands on every single one of them inside a barn or something like that. So treating them a certain way, you know, helps them grow and then ultimately taste better on the plate because you've given them a low-stress life.
Having that certification is sort of rare in the United States, isn't it?
Well, there's a ton of different certifications. Certified Humane, which you can find at certifiedhumane.org, is the most stringent of them all, for sure. You know, one of the challenges is that the slaughterhouse also has to be certified humane because they cover the whole process. So in that instance, our packing plant had to buy a fairly expensive, you know, machine and have it carted over here from Denmark. And we put down the animals in the same way a veterinarian would put down a cat or a dog. And that really brings it home because obviously millions and millions and millions of people love their pets at home. And those same people often ask producers about the well-being of the animal and so forth because they don't want to be moral relativists. They want to treat animals right across the board. And it's a good thing to be able to tell them what we do, how we do it, and that other people recognize us as truthful and good at what we do.
I know that you employ a master swine herder. This is something else I've never heard of before. What is that?
Well, Poppy, I thought I was a master swine herder, but I was wrong. For many years, I did this by myself, and I learned a lot, and I was okay at it. But then in came Eufren Curo Ramos from Bolivia. And Eufren is old school, to put it mildly. He carries a machete. He's only in his late 20s or something like that, but doesn't trouble me with a bunch of Lowe's receipts, doesn't need to ask me for permission to repair something, just gets after it with his own resources. So he's a terrific farm manager, and then the way in which he takes care of the pigs is unsurpassed in America. I would put him up against anybody and everybody. It's incredible. He sleeps with the pigs.
He does not.
He does. When they're sick, when they have a problem, he brings them home, and if they're the right size, as in not 200 pounds, you sleep with them.
Wow.
Yeah, no kidding. But I advocate this for any farmer, let alone livestock farmer, but it's difficult to do. But keeping solid track of your inventory and records on each and every animal, and that's been a great learning experience, too. If a pig literally has a scratch or some type of disturbance, it gets noted.
Mm-hmm.
There's hundreds of pigs, and we know on paper at least, every single one of them. And going through there is a terrific experience because they know us and we know them.
Well, you're obviously taking extraordinary care of your pigs, and I'm sure that that translates into the product on the plate. How do you market your meat, and who's buying it?
Well, I'll take the plate question first. Even if you weren't into animal welfare per se, I mean, I've had people come up to me before and tell me that they didn't care about the certified humane element, it translates to meat quality. So if you have a stressful day, you as a human being, your radio show isn't going right or whatever, your shoulders seize up, you get sore and all that, and in an animal, that is tough meat. So when your brain sends a message to the muscle that it is stressed, it comes with chemicals in it that toughen the meat. So that's why you want a calm atmosphere and gentle treatment and humane death even, so that when it gets to the plate, it's the very best it can be. And that's the problem with industrial agriculture. When you go into the big box stores and see 15-20% injected water, et cetera, what they're trying to do at the very end with all the flavorings and all the brine and all the other stuff is correct for problems that happened preconception.
Yeah.
That go all the way down the line to their unfortunate death. And
yeah,
the whole thing is stressful. The whole thing makes lousy meat, and we avoid it all. So who do we sell to? We sell to chefs all across America via FedEx, callcalkree.com. My chefs usually call me. We figure out a deal dependably or whatever.
Well, I want to talk about how weary you are of the southern stereotype of cooking, like cheap fried chicken and Crisco crust. And I've even heard you kind of diss about shrimp and grits. So what is southern food to you?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not. It's not, and we are not, a cartoon. Like, if you were an Italian-American person from New Jersey and everyone asked you if you were in the mafia, would it get sort of tiresome?
Sure.
Exactly. We're not all on The Sopranos, right? So that's what it's like for me, and certainly a lot of other people in the South, is that grating image of certain big-haired, overly cheerful and bossy Southern women on TV, come on. And then, unfortunately, like, that becomes a projected image, and those kinds of images are, you know, are rhetorical ambassadors, if you will.
So what is Southern food to you? Name me some of your favorites.
When you look back at Southern history and a way of looking at all the ingredients from a historical perspective, here in South Carolina, Southern food is different from Georgia and from North Carolina and so forth. So Southern food really is more colloquial than what is defined as Southern food. So in Europe, for example, there's a definite notion about terroir, about the exact place in which a food can be grown. So, you know, from olive oils to cheeses and so forth, there are definitive regions where one would find particular foods. And it's sort of unusual, really, in America, we're not that definitive. And what I aim to do here is help people begin breaking down the nuances within those larger regions. And since I'm from the South, we talk about the South. So it's not just so broadly brushed.
The taste of place in the truest sense.
Yes.
So I understand you have some political ambitions.
Well, I would say less political ambitions than an ambition to correct agriculture as is the status quo in the state and nation today. That's my goal, being a politician, or particularly running for Commissioner of Agriculture here in South Carolina, is just one tool that you can use to accomplish that goal. So I have less political goals and more towards the practical in the agricultural realm.
Emil DeFelice, agent of change, right?
If you say so, Poppy. Emil DeFelice, tired fellow.
I know.
Needs a break.
Thank you so much for taking the time out and away from those pigs to chat with us. So, thanks.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Emil DeFelice, pig farmer of the New South.
Everywhere there's lots of piggies living piggy lives. You can see them out for dinner with their piggy wives, clutching forks and knives to eat the bacon.
And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the name Brazilians use for the vegetable we locally call melitão, is chuchu. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, if you paid close attention in your world history class during high school, you might have had an advantage in last week's quiz. Although called chayote throughout most of Spanish-influenced Latin America, the Portuguese have dominated the Brazilian landscape since the 15th century, naming this indigenous squash chuchu. So congratulations to Alina Maester for winning our culinary quiz, and thanks to you for suffering through my pompous history lesson.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of Leah Chase's celebrated New Orleans restaurant? Email your answers to LouisianaEats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of Leah Chase's celebrated New Orleans restaurant? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at wwno.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Louisiana native Trey Lytle is president of a new rum distillery, Louisiana Spirits. Louisiana Spirits is currently under construction in southwest Louisiana in Lacassine. Trey, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I would like you to start us at the very beginning and explain what has inspired you to build a new rum distillery in southwest Louisiana.
My goodness, we have been working on this for a long time. It takes a lot longer than you think, I'll tell you that. We've been talking about it in a duck blind for about 5 or 6 years, and then we have been diligently working on this for a year. I worked in the rum business for years for Bacardi. We have always talked about the fact that why isn't there a distillery in the state of Louisiana with so much sugarcane? And we just decided it's time. So we did get motivated by what's happening in other parts of the United States. Oregon is a hotbed of distilleries, Kentucky. And so we visited many, many distilleries around and decided, why can't we do that in Louisiana?
And describe for us a little bit about the distillery you're building, what's going to go on there.
Well, the building is underway. You can see it as you're driving down Interstate 10 now. It'll be complete probably around April, we're thinking. We're building in the middle of what used to be a rice field, 18,000 square foot building. About 12,000 square feet is going to be the warehouse where the distillery equipment is. The rest of it is going to be a gift shop, a tasting room, and a viewing room. And in the viewing room, we'll have some curated exhibits about the history of rum making in Louisiana.
Oh, that is so cool. So this is going to be a good reason for an excursion into southwest Louisiana, it sounds like, huh?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning also with how do you distill rum? What is the process?
Rum distilling is really an art. It's an art form. What goes in are great raw materials, great equipment, and a great process in order to produce a world-class rum, and that's our goal. The process of making rum starts with sugar cane, where you take molasses, which is a byproduct of the sugar process, raw sugar. You put it into a big container and cause it to ferment by adding water and yeast, which ferments. Then you put the fermented liquid into a still, and you basically boil it, but you don't boil it at 212 degrees. You only boil it to get the alcohol to come out of it. Then you take that and you put it into a finishing still. Again, it's heat induced, and you get rum. We're building our facility so that we can do 500-gallon batches. And out of that 500 gallons, you'll get about 75 gallons of rum. We're going to have, of course, a clear rum, which is the most common. People drink that like a vodka. We'll also have a spiced rum, and we'll have a mature rum, also a dark rum.
I understand, Trey, that from the very earliest days of sugarcane production, it was very, very common to have a rum distillery right there on the property. Can you tell me about the history of that and what you know?
It's amazing history. At the very beginning of sugarcane industry, they had designs on making rum because they were making rum in the islands. And so Manuel Solis came over with the idea to grow sugarcane and make rum. And then in 1764, a Spanish gentleman who produced the first sugar shipped 160 barrels of sugar, 55 barrels of molasses, and 18 barrels of rum on the very first shipping log, and it was recognized by the Spanish crown.
Now, I understand that the practice of making rum here in Louisiana continued in the plantation sugar houses till about the Civil War. Why did it disappear? Why do you think the tradition went away?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it went away because the stills were destroyed by the Union soldiers. They confiscated Louisiana rum. There's a lot of historical references to Louisiana rum. And for some reason, the art was lost. and it wasn't put back by the sugar mills. Sugar mills have been under pressure to make money, and you know, they just haven't had extra money around to be able to build a distillery, I don't think.
Well, the sugar production in Louisiana has had a real rough time, and so in essence, by bringing back this old tradition, you're really giving them a hand. Do you have some specific sugar growing operations that you're going to be working with? How are you sourcing your ingredients?
Mm-hmm. We're in the process of sourcing our ingredients now, and of course they're coming from Louisiana. Every sugar mill in Louisiana is a potential source for us. So I will say this, sugar industry in Louisiana has done a phenomenal job without any subsidies, by the way, to make money in, you know, in a fairly difficult environment to grow sugar cane.
Trey, I want to thank you so much for coming over to visit us here at Louisiana Eats, and we'll return the favor and come see you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Trey Lytle of Louisiana Spirit. Edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, just in time for Valentine's Day, Bittersweet Chocolates' Cheryl Scripter.
I was surprised that people really wanted those traditional flavors. As much fun as I have creating the kind of out there flavors, I really found that the core business was keeping it simple, because I think people appreciated just the really nice taste of a good piece of chocolate.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe and the Bourbon House, Leitzegan Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cooking Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to Thomas Walsh, our associate producer and sound engineer. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.